the film with three brains. It's 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 the film with three brains.
Oh my god, you guys are freaks.
Welcome to the film with three brains. I'm Cohen in Maplewood, New Jersey.
This is Sean in Chicago.
Sam in San Francisco.
And the movie we are discussing today is the 1979 cult classic The Warriors, directed by Walter Hill and starring a whole bunch of people maybe you'll recognize, but no one knows who they are, really. So, The Warriors. This is a personal favorite of mine. I have some nostalgia for it for a couple of reasons. First of all, had you guys ever seen this before?
No. I've never seen it.
No? That's interesting.
Yeah,
I've seen it lots of times, but I have a specific reason. So you've never seen it before. So what's your first impressions?
First impressions. Well, I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought it would, because when they start introducing the gangs, Well, first of all, the first thing, Amy was in the room and she's like, "Oh, I've been on that." You know, the giant Ferris wheel.
Yeah.
First shot.
The Wonder Wheel. It's in Coney Island.
The Wonder Wheel. Yeah. I've been to Coney Island. I don't think I ever went on that, but she was like, "Oh yeah,
I lived in Brooklyn for 20 years and I've never been on the Wonder Wheel."
But yeah, what concerned me was when they're introducing the gangs and the third gang they show is a bunch of mimes with top hats. I was like, "Oh my, what kind of movie have we gotten into here?" But that was it. Like it went up and up from there. I mean, more or less.
Yeah. All right. So wait, sorry, let me interrupt. Let me just give a quick rundown for our listeners who have never seen it, which is probably all of them or one of them. I don't know. Anyway, The Warriors is about a gang from Brooklyn in 1979 New York who goes up to the Bronx, which is really far by New York City standards, to go to like basically a gang convention in the big park in the Bronx. And all the major gangs are there. They're all represented by nine guys with no weapons. And they're there to be united, basically to take over the city. There's one guy named Cyrus who is sort of the spokesperson. He's the one and only, as they call him. He's trying to unite all the gangs of New York City to take over New York City, one borough at a time, basically take it from the police and from organized crime, the mob. So that's the broad strokes. Things go south and everyone thinks the Warriors are responsible for a heinous act in the beginning. And they have to make their way back from the Bronx to Brooklyn with every other major gang in New York hunting them. So it's a pretty good premise, I think. I like it.
Yeah, I like how fast it goes right away.
Yeah. It doesn't waste any time getting to it.
Yeah. It's a perfect setup. I think your picks so far have been cult fight films. But this one is, because it's so early, is a total setup for so many other movies after it that kind of like escape the situation and get plucked off one by one sort of setup. And it's even like Aliens where it's a whole group in one situation and the leader gets plucked off right away and then the rest have to try to organize and escape. You just kind of see in which Walter Hill was part of, but you see that element. And so to me, this is a movie that is I think you've established yourself as the film 101 person who's going to teach everyone about movies, where Sean and I are just going to randomly pick movies that made us giggle. That's what I think you're like, hey, this person did this first. I don't know that they did it best, but they did it first. Right.
Well, don't worry. I'm sure I'll have picks in the future that are utterly and totally frivolous.
You expect nothing less.
I got a couple in mind. So, Sean found it surprisingly watchable. And then Sam, what were your sort of yay, nay impressions, thumbs up, thumbs down kind of thing?
So I think that this is an interesting movie. It's not one that I would say, hey, you got to go out and see this. If someone's really interested, in, like I said, in movie history or whatever, had seen Like if they're at the ranks of where we are, where we've seen 2,000 or 3,000 movies, and you're looking for another movie you haven't seen, sure. But I think it's dated enough that if there's enough like cringy moments, like it just like women are totally objects, you know, that, in this movie. You know, it's like you realize, and like things too, like it was totally normal to use the word faggot then, but to see it now and hear it so much, you just start cringing.
Yeah,
you know, so these things that as the times have changed. You know things that used to be normal aren't normal at all, and they're actually totally wrong. So I think those elements, but the overall structure of the movie I really liked. I think there was one weird thing that happened when I was watching this. So it was at the beginning when they're organizing all the gangs. Vivian came home and she's and like walks into the door, and in 5 seconds she's like, "Are you watching The Warriors?" And I was like, yeah, how in the world did you like? I didn't even know you would recognize this. And she looks at the TV screen. She's like, "No, you're not. You're watching some movie." I'm like, "Oh, you mean the basketball game?" She's like, "Yeah, I just heard that Curry broke his hand."
She's talking the Golden State Warriors.
Yes, she was driving home and heard on the radio, and then she saw me sitting in front of the TV and just assumed I was watching the game.
I've known you to be a huge Warriors fan. Yes.
It was one of those, it was the most surreal thing that happened during the watching of this movie.
That's saying a lot.
So,
yeah, this is the earliest movie we've reviewed. So,
yeah,
I was expecting some pretty dicey moments.
Yeah, I mean, part of me wonders too is like, obviously the way films were made in the late 70s is totally different than now, and the content and the way people treated each other. And I got to say that we went from the Patrick Swayze with mostly decent, sometimes cheesy choreographed fights to really bad choreography for the fighting. So you have to be there's able to get past that to watch.
There's
this
a couple
movie.
Of moments here and there in the sort of the action-y fighty scenes. There's a couple of moments here and there, little sequences where if you're watching, you might think, "Oh, wow, that was well done." But they're few and far between. I mean, it's pretty raw, and I don't know. Someone might argue that kind of gives it its sort of helps give it its gritty feel, that nothing's very well choreographed and it all feels very sloppy. I don't know. One of the reasons I like this so much is because it is, I can't be certain if it is the first movie I saw on VHS, but is one of three movies, the first ones I saw on VHS. And I remember very specifically because my Uncle Rick had the first VHS record deck I'd ever seen when I was very young. And it was huge. You know, it was like size of a microwave. It had the buttons you push in on top and they stay pushed in. And the tape thing came up off the top.
And yeah, top loader.
And they had a satellite dish. And I don't know where the signals were coming from, but they had one movie channel. And he used to record some movies. And the one videotape he always had laying around that I remember had The Warriors on it. And it had Flash Gordon. And it had Watcher in the Woods. And so every time I visited, they didn't really have cable television. They just had the satellite dish with a handful of channels of weird stuff. And then we'd watch those. So I've seen The Warriors a million times, I've seen Flash Gordon a million times, and I've seen Watcher in the Woods a million times. So it just always stuck with me in that regard. And I was always fond of it as a result, because as a young man, a little kid, I mean, geez, watching it didn't seem hokey. It seemed scary and exciting and strange and kind of cartoony ultimately. Kind of comic booky. I read an interview once with Walter Hill, who directed it, who said he always envisioned this story as being a comic book. And so he had originally wanted to shoot it more with that sort of aesthetic, but this whoever produced it, the studio that funded it, was like, "No, we're not doing that. That's crazy." So he released a version a few years ago, I don't remember when, where he sort of re-edited it and applied all these comic book aesthetics to it and gave it panels, kind of like if you remember Ang Lee's Hulk, where he would do split screen so it looked like comic book panels. He did that with The Warriors, and I don't know. I would say it was a lateral move. You know, didn't make it any better, but didn't make it any worse. So it was just different.
Yeah, it was the 2005 Ultimate Director's Cut DVD.
Yeah,
they did that.
Yeah, and I saw it once when they first did it because I was curious, and I didn't care enough to buy it or anything like that. I had already had the Warriors on DVD. I don't have it on Blu-ray, which I kind of regret because the transfer on the DVD is really pretty terrible. But that's all right.
Yeah, 2005 was also when the video game version came out, and apparently it was kind of well received. And I can see why it plays. I mean, it feels like a video game kind of.
Sure. Yeah.
It totally is because you go through. It's set up in stages, you know, it's the subway stage, it's the graveyard stage, it's the, you know, and
different weapons.
A little factoid about the subway scenes. If you look real close, you know, it's like 96th Street is the one where a lot of it takes place in the beginning, and they're like, we got to get to Union Square. So there's a scene in Union Square. But in those scenes, if you look closely at the far walls in any given shot, it says Hoyt on all of them. Because Hoyt Skirmerhorn in Brooklyn is where they shoot and have pretty much always shot any subway scene in a movie. Because the Hoyt Skirmerhorn station, which I used to pass through every single day when I lived in Clinton Hill in Brooklyn, has extra tracks on the outside that are unused. There's extra platforms, and they just use them for garbage trains and for film shoots. And it's been that way since the 70s, maybe in the 60s. Michael Jackson's Bad was shot at Hoyt Skirmerhorn, if you remember that music video. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I thought it was funny. That's watching it. My wife and I were watching it, and she goes, hey, does it say Hoyt on the wall? Yeah. Isn't that supposed to be 96th Street? Yeah. I don't know if they just didn't have the budget to replace the far, like they didn't care. You know, I don't know.
You mentioned the fighting being kind of hokey, and I mean it was a little bit hokey, but I think more than that, just the name Bopping was what kind of threw me off. what are you, Little Bunny Foo Foo?
I know. And to me, that felt like maybe like a 50s holdover, you know, from something like The Wild One, you know, Marlon Brando. I don't know, old biker gang lingo. I don't know. Maybe gangs in the 70s smoked that. I doubt it.
Well, the book goes back to 65 or something, and then it said it might even go back before that.
Yeah, I read the book when I was in college, and I don't remember it very well at all. I just remember it was quite different. But I know that the book was based on the Greek story.
Odyssey?
It's called the Anabasis.
Oh.
And it's about a part of the Greek army being trapped behind enemy lines and having to fight their way home. And I also, you know, in that regard, I heard before he had passed away that Tony Scott was working on a remake of The Warriors set in L.A., where someone has to get from, you know, northern Los Angeles down to like Long Beach or something and fighting all the other, you know, gangs in L.A.
I thought this movie's totally ripe for a remake. And I thought you could even do it. A little more comically, like you have to get through the white jeaned hipsters, you know, in Chelsea, and the yuppies, and not get hit by a Mercedes or guy driving a Mercedes texting on his iPhone.
It both aesthetically and just sort of thematically, it reminds me a lot of Escape from New York, which is also a personal favorite. Just imagine Snake Plissken as, you know, nine guys instead of one thing, you know.
You probably imagine that a lot.
one other minor factoid about the book. The guy who wrote it, Saul Urich, I lived on the same block as him in Brooklyn, the last place I lived before my wife and I moved to New Jersey. He had passed away a few years before we moved, but his widow still lived on the block. And I never met her, but another person who lived on the block invited me to join their book club, which she was a part of. I politely declined. So I never got to meet her, but again, tenuous connection.
Yeah. I mean, the whole New York setting has got to be, you know, meaningful to you in some ways, but could it be done in a different city?
Sure. I think it'd be done anywhere. I think if it were remade, I think it would have to be almost like a post-apocalyptic type thing. Mm-hmm. It couldn't be really contemporary. I mean, there are still gangs in New York, of course, but not like this. I mean, the 70s, New York in the 70s was rough. You know, it was a bankrupt city. There was violence. Crime rate was astronomical. Gangs were, you know, really prevalent. And of course, they weren't, their faces weren't painted white, roller skating around in baseball uniforms and goofy shit like that. But still, you know, it was a rough city to be in. So today, New York's one of the safest cities in the world, or, you know, safest big cities in the world. So you'd have to, yeah, either maybe like Detroit or something. Or again, maybe it's just, it's an alternate universe kind of thing. It's a future kind of thing. I don't know. I think, Sam, I think you're right. Definitely this, as much as I love the Warriors in the right hands, it could be a really interesting remake.
There would have to be more guns, I think.
Yeah. Weird, right? There's almost no guns in it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes sense though, to a certain extent, because they say, you know, no one can come strapped,
right?
You know, they everyone's, you know. The one thing that kind of bothers me about the movie is that the guy who kills Cyrus, oh, sorry, spoiler alert. Someone kills Cyrus in the beginning. Anyway,
yeah,
that sets that's what starts it off.
It is, the actor's name is David Patrick Kelly.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. And in listeners, you may recognize the name. He was, I think the most famous thing I think of is Twin Peaks. He was the bizarre brother of the hotel owner. Who was always eating sandwiches, but really it was just buttered bread. Oh my God, the sandwich is so good. And it was like, it was a hero. It was, you know, or it was like a, what do you call it? It was like hero bread with butter on it. He's like, this sandwich is amazing. I'm like, I don't know if you call that a sandwich. Anyway, that's him. He was also the bad guy in Dreamscape, if you remember that one.
Oh, man.
Okay, you and I are going two totally different directions on him. Yeah. Because the moment I saw him, I was like, oh, I recognize this guy. Yep. And there was two reasons I recognized him. And the first, the real one, it took me a while to come to me. Because the other one was because of the John Wick movies, which was more recent. He was the cleaner. His name was Charlie in the John Wick movies, in the first two John Wick movies. But the real reason I recognized his face, because he has that narrow chin, that pointy chin. And I was like, who is he? Who is he? And then he gets, Sean, you know who it is?
I'm the guy from Commandos, huh?
Yeah. It's Sully.
Oh, right.
Like, yeah. Sully from Commandos. You promised you'd kill me last. You died. You could drop some, you know?
That's right.
Yeah.
So that was, yeah. And so that's him. Yeah. And he was, yeah, I thought that was an interesting scene leading up to it, because I didn't understand why the gun had to be handed across 20 people if you're trying to do something,
right? You
know, and blame someone else for it.
The thing that bothers me about it is he shoots this dude for literally no reason. He even says so.
Yeah, he says that.
They're like, why'd you shoot him? He's like, I don't know. I just like to do stuff like that. And you're like, what? Okay. All right. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and then the end part, when he's clinking the glasses together, that was one of my favorite parts.
Right. I feel like that's like the only quotable. There's two parts of this movie that I think are quotable that in my mind I have always repeated. And that's, one is Warriors come out to play when he's clinking the bottles, which apparently he ad-libbed. Yep. I read something that he asked Walter Hill, you know, what the hell am I supposed to be saying here? And he's like, I don't know, I'll think of something. So he did that with the bottles, which was, you know, unsettling. Well, and then and then the Cyrus, you know, his opening speech where he'd say, you know, whatever, sucker, can you dig it? And they're like, yeah. And he goes, can you dig it?
Yeah, I love that's the rallying cry that everyone responds to.
And he calls them all suckers.
Suckers.
Can you count, suckers? Because if you can count. All right, anyway.
Yeah, well, actually, it's kind of math, because then he goes in through the, 60,000 of you, and 40,000 right. cops, and it's like, wait, whoa, slow down there. But yeah, also counting.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I wanted to talk about the cast a little bit. There are some notable people in it. Like David Patrick Kelly, I think is somewhat notable. The lead is a dude named Michael Beck. No one probably recognizes because
it was bothering me. Yeah, it was bothering me.
He was in the Warriors, and then his follow up was Xanadu with Elizabeth John, which if anyone has seen, which I have, knows that it's just horrible. I mean, it's bananas goofy. again, involves some roller skating.
Yes, it does. It's Michael the same
cannot sing or dance. Why they cast him in a musical, I'll never understand. He's awful. He's just awful.
He was nominated for a Razzie for that too, actually.
Yeah. Was that Sam?
Did you hear Michael Beck's quote regarding that?
No.
What he said? He said, the movie The Warriors opened a lot of doors for me. which Xanadu immediately shut. He was never cast as a leading character. He was always supporting after that, after Xanadu.
Well, he did one TV show that I actually used to watch when I was a little kid. It was called Houston Nights, and it was him and Michael Paré, who's actually the lead in Walter Hill's, I think, follow-up to The Warriors, which is Streets of Fire, which is another sort of, what am I trying to say? Like a sort of dystopian, you know, timeless sort of story where you don't know when it's supposed to be or exactly where it's supposed to be. But Michael Paré was really that. And those two were in this television series where they played cops in Houston. And I used to watch it. I thought it was great. Of course, I was like 10 and didn't know any better. But yeah, I don't know if he ever made another movie after Xanadu, Michael Beck.
He has credits for a lot of smaller parts, but he never had.
He was never the lead anything again.
Yeah.
So he's a lead. And then, you know, one of the other more notable people, I think, is James Remar. He's really young in this, but he's had a very long, long career. His IMDb page is enormous. People today would probably most remember him as Dexter's dad in Dexter. Other than that, I mean, he's been in so much stuff. I don't even know. I mean, he was the bad guy in 48 Hours with Eddie Murphy and Nick Nolte, also a Walter Hill movie.
Yeah, he's a pretty good bat. I mean, he is a villain in a lot of stuff he's in.
Yeah.
He's real gruff and he looks like a baddie.
Yeah. I mean, his IMDb page is just huge. I mean, it's just huge. This guy has been in so much. And most of it's TV, but I mean, still, you know, when you have 10 to 15 entries a year for the last 30 years, I mean, it's pretty impressive.
So I some other people stuck out to me. When I saw the lips of the DJ, I'm like, I know this actress.
Yep,
and
me too.
And so it's Lynn Thigpen, who was the chief in a bunch of the Carmen Sandiego films, and she was in the movie Lean on Me.
That's what Sam said. We were watching, my wife, she's like, she said, I recognize her. Oh, I totally recognize her. And then she said, Carmen, she's like, have you ever seen Carmen Sandiego? I'm like, no, I have not. I have no idea what this is.
Yeah. It's not the voice, though. The voice is someone else.
It's.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That's weird.
So, yeah, I recognized her. And then
did you recognize Miss Mercedes Rule?
Yes. Yes. She's in the park on the bench. And
yeah. Yeah.
I was confused about what her, like, because at first I'm like, okay, she's an undercover cop. And then, but she didn't, she wasn't, she was just, I don't know, she was a vigilante or what?
No, I think she was an undercover cop.
She was a cop.
Yeah, I think so. She doesn't identify herself as such, but the fact that she's blowing a whistle and there's a zillion cops right there, they just turned their lights on and they were already there, makes you think that it was some sort of setup or like some sort of, you know, things have gone bad in that park and they're there to try and catch people.
Yeah, and Ajax or James Remar seems like a real dolt for always thinking with the wrong brain.
Right.
You know, right. He foreshadows it early on, like, hey, you know, it'd be nice on the way back, you know.
Right, on like, the way back.
Yeah. And then they kind of like review that, like, okay, this is really important that we get home, stick together. And then they break all those rules time and time again, you know.
Oh, but, yeah, totally.
But I mean, that makes it more fun, of course.
And then did you guys, you know, the woman who plays the lead, you know, the female lead, if there is one in this, the woman they pick up from the orphans, the goofy orphan guys. Yeah. I recognize her from, I've always known who she was, but you might recognize her. If you ever seen that sitcom with Ted Knight called Too Close for Comfort.
Oh, I have seen
daughters live in the basement. She's one of the adult daughters with MJ Bullock.
Yeah. Her name's Deborah Van Valkenburg. Yeah. She's been in a ton of stuff. And in the movie she's Mercy, but this is a little coincidental thing that Cochise in the movie and Mercy both end up as characters in single but not the same episodes of MacGyver. I thought you'd like that. The other person is Paul Greco, who's the in Next of Kin with Patrick Swayze.
Yeah,
going back to your.
That's not what I was thinking.
No, but he's also Sean. What are you gonna say?
He's Raul and the Cable Guy.
Yeah, and the Cable Guy, right?
Yes, he is.
He sings the song karaoke.
Don't rock the boat. Don't rock the boat.
Yeah, right. And then he points weirdly at the end and does this little.
Is he the one? Isn't he holding the microphone upside down as well?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. but
the orphans were interesting because that was like kind of giving you some insight into the hierarchy. I mean, I think Cyrus says in the beginning there's like 100 gangs and 100 more, and so this is one of the lower echelon gangs,
but like affiliates.
Yeah, but that whole scene is like, okay, so we establish, you know, there's other gangs that are trying to get involved and can't. And then this, you know, the woman kind of calls everybody out, says you're all a bunch of, I don't know if she says pussies or what she says, but
yeah.
And then kind of keeps driving that whole, well, I mean, he gets Paul Greco, whatever his name is, he gets them to agree to take off their collars and then they don't. And it's like,
right,
that's odd. Okay. And then it's all, everyone's trying to save face and yeah. And then it leads to a Molotov cocktail and. You know,
right.
No one else has a description of that whole thing or any impressions, but I thought that was pretty cool. The whole part of it.
Yeah, totally. I just looked up Michael Beck's filmography on IMDb because I was curious. And I noticed that not too long after The Warriors, he's in a movie called Megaforce. Which has always been on my radar. I don't know why. It's directed by Hal Needham. Who is the stunt guy who worked with Burt Reynolds. Smoking the Bandit and all that stuff. Hal Needham was the stunt guy who turned director to make all those movies. And mm-hmm. But the lead in Megaforce is Barry Bostwick. And he looks really silly because he has this big beard, this big poofy hair. But if either of you guys ever watched Spin City, he's the mayor. Yeah.
Oh, that's the mayor.
So it's funny that in his youth, he starred as sort of an action, a sci-fi action hero.
as opposed to the terrible
hokey movie called Megaforce.
That's cool.
But Walter Hill, you know, who directed The Warriors, he's made a few, you know, legitimately good movies. You know, 48 Hours really is the one that comes to mind. You know, that 48 Hours made Eddie Murphy a superstar, you know, a film star. He was already pretty popular from SNL, but then he left SNL to make 48 Hours.
He did?
Yeah. And that really launched his film career. And, you know, from day one, that's it. He was a superstar.
Did you hear that Eddie Murphy is going to host Saturday Night Live in December or something?
Yeah, I heard he's doing all kinds of stuff. He's hosting Saturday Night Live. And then again, you know, calling back to our Twins discussion, supposedly he was going to be in a sequel with those guys. And then I heard he's doing a stand-up tour again or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's preparing for another stand-up tour. He discusses it on his episode of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee with Jerry Seinfeld, if you've ever seen that. He's on that and he talks about it. It was the most recent season.
Real quick, going back to our Twins episode, Walter Hill wrote and directed Red Heat, which I think during our Twins episode you mentioned was a terrible movie. Mm-hmm. So
it's not great. but after 48 Hours, he did Streets of Fire, which I love. It's a lot like The Warriors. You know, it's kind of hokey, but I don't know. There's some interesting ideas there, and it's got a great cast. And Brewster's Millions then after that, which I
love.
That should be on our list.
Yeah. a few action duds like Extreme Prejudice, Red Heat, Johnny Handsome with Mickey Rourke. And then he did the sequel to 48 Hours, another 48 Hours. And then he did Trespass, which came out the year we graduated from high school and was a personal favorite there for a few years.
What's Trespass?
I've never seen it.
Trespass is Bill Paxton and William Sadler. I don't remember who else. I can't remember the exact premise. They go into like a shitty part of some city because they know there's something there valuable, like a duffel bag full of money, and they try and steal it. And they run afoul of drug dealer types and have to kind of fight their way out, not unlike The Warriors. But they're just average Joes. You know, they're just dudes. But it's good. I mean, I should say I remember it being good, or I remember liking it. That doesn't mean it's actually good.
Right.
I mean, my tastes when I was, 17, who am I kidding?
Your tastes are
pretty much the same as they are now.
Yeah, we're waiting to see where you're going to go with that.
You're going to paint yourself into my corner.
I would just like, along that same vein, I would just like to say that my wife and I went to see a movie on Friday night. And we never see movies in the theater anymore because we have a son who's 15 months or 16 months old and we don't have a babysitter. And so we were at the in-laws in Delaware and we got to go see a movie, and we could have seen Joker with Joaquin Phoenix, could have seen The Lighthouse from the guy who did The Witch. And we saw neither of those. Instead, we saw Terminator Dark Fate.
I saw that Friday too.
And that was all my doing. My wife's like, I'll see whatever you want. I don't care. I was like, all right, well, we're going for low-hanging fruit here.
Yeah. Zombieland, the sequel.
That was playing too.
Yeah.
Like, none of that. We're seeing the umpteenth Terminator sequel, reboot, whatever you want to call it. We shouldn't get into that too deeply, but I enjoyed it.
I did too.
I thought it was the best thing
since Terminator 2.
Oh, totally.
You didn't mention that Walter Hill wrote and produced... Aliens.
Oh,
he has a writing credit for Aliens and the production.
Someone else wrote it. That's interesting. His writing career. I mean, he's directed quite a few movies, but he's written a lot too. I mean, He's written most of the things he's directed, but he's written a few other things too. Yeah.
He has writing or production credit on the first Alien and writing and production on Aliens, and then same with Alien 3. Then it just gets worse.
Yeah. He's still out there making movies here and there. Like, I remember seeing Bullet to the Head with Sylvester Stallone and Jason Momoa before Jason Momoa did Game of Thrones. I enjoyed the hell out of it. I think I'm literally the only person on the planet who saw it.
Yeah.
But it was pretty good.
Yeah, he directed that one.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the music for a moment?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Barry DeVorzin. Go ahead.
I was gonna cut you off and steal your thunder, but that's rude.
You can. I mean, I don't have a lot of thunder. I just was interested by a few things about the music.
Yeah, what were you interested about?
I had to look up Barry DeVorzin. I wouldn't know who that is, but he did a ton of stuff. He wrote the theme for SWAT, and I think in the credits or somewhere you see, so that it ends with the Joe Walsh song in the city.
Right.
And he co-wrote that with Joe Walsh. Oh. And I'm not a big Eagles guy, but I mean, that's gotta be like his best song. Joe Walsh's best song. Cause the Eagles then were like, oh, that's pretty good. Let's take it. And then he tours on it. They used it. They loved it. And, really it came from that sort of feel of whatever. I don't know what, I mean, the rest of the stuff is very disco-y and kind of 70s-ish, but that seemed more quasi-modern or something. It just really worked.
A lot of it is some of the music sounds almost like sound effects, you know, very synthesizer heavy, you know, strange things. I really like that about it, actually. I think there's been sort of a recent uptick in that style of soundtrack for stuff that's really been being spearheaded by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, of all the people. Those two guys have scored a whole bunch of movies in the last few years that have that sort of synthy feel, including the new Watchmen series on HBO, which is quite good if you guys haven't seen it. They scored the last few David Fincher movies. If you remember the soundtrack to The Social Network in particular, It has that sort of synth 80s synthesizer feel throughout the whole thing. I really like it a lot. Drive has it too, but they didn't do that.
Okay. He also did
Tangerine Dream feel.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. He also did Xanadu. So
same guy.
Yeah. Same guy.
Eric DeVorzin.
Although I always think of ELO as part of that. So
ELO. Certainly. Yeah.
But yeah, it definitely set a tone and mood, and, then, I mean, the DJ thing was odd be just because like, what, this happened, this goes all night. It's like 8 hours. That's a long DJ shift, you know? I mean, but right. I guess it's supposed to be an underground. That's obviously, she's sending messages to the boppers and the updates and everything. And that was interesting. But I mean, I don't know. Yeah. Other than what do you remember any songs that she actually put on?
Well, the only one I remember is Nowhere to Run.
Yeah,
Nowhere to Hide. I don't remember if the song's called Nowhere to Run or Nowhere to Hide, but she plays that. She's like, this one's going out to the Warriors, and she plays that. And that's it. That's early on when they first are running. I think they even before they even realize that they're being blamed for that guy's death, they don't even realize that. They just know that a truce had been in effect for this big meeting, and chances are there was no truce.
Right. Yeah, how did they realize that? Did they get word, or does someone just say, hey, you shot him, and they're like, no.
I can't remember. They do figure it out, though. And oh, and this really bothered my wife. The one guy who saw it happen, the one warrior who saw it happen, he saw the guy shoot Cyrus.
Yeah.
He never says a damn word.
That's about weird.
It. It's so strange. He's just like, I'm not going to mention this. This isn't important. Let's just go run for our lives. And then he gets, I think he's the same dude who ends up getting chucked on the tracks at one point by a cop.
Oh, that makes sense then, because he didn't have time to speak up.
No. This the
end. That's not the guy.
Oh, yeah. They all escape. They rendezvous and then they split up and all that stuff happens. There was plenty of time for him to stop and say, "Oh, by the way, the entire city of New York thinks we killed this dude."
Well, also the gun got pulled on him because before the cops lights, the floodlights came on, he was raising the gun again to shoot him.
Right.
So you think he'd be like, "Oh, that guy almost shot me," you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of important information. So yeah, we found the one plot hole in the whole thing, I think.
Yes, exactly.
The only one there is. Otherwise, it's tight.
So this movie was made for $4 million, and it made $22.5 million at the box office. And it was pulled at a number of times, or the showings were limited because they were afraid that it would instill violence. That during the filming, they used a lot of gangs in New York as part of the filming. And they even hired one gang to protect the equipment at night for $500 a night, because other gangs that were not in the movie were mad and were wrecking or threatening them during the filming. Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
A little too real. I'm guessing the mime gang was not the ones that were threatening them.
I want to know the story behind that.
And the roller gang. I mean, what was the suspenders all about? It was like suspenders and roller skates.
Right. It was like the roller farmers. You know, they're all wearing these denim overalls and rollers. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
That was odd. And then the baseball Furies always cracked me up because they're clown faces and their silly baseball uniforms, and they're all carrying bats instead of guns.
Yeah. And conveniently they're Yankee pinstripes, but no Yankee. Remember?
Right. Right.
You know, sure.
So. Yeah.
The fighting with the bats is some of the worst.
Yeah. But then they have bats after that, right? That's
right. They level up.
I just wanted to mention about the music, I like the song in the city, the Eagles song at the end. It did feel a little out of place.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard for me to think of it from the first time I saw it, just giving it thought now. It's just, I don't know. It feels a little, I don't know. It's like this, I keep thinking it's this adult contemporary song, although I don't know if that's quite the right genre, sort of soft rock. I don't know, but it just, I don't know. It feels out of place. I'd expect something a little more edge to close out the Warriors, you know?
Well, I think it was supposed to be happy because they got to the beach and they're like, oh, once we see the ocean, we feel safe. And he's like, not this time. And then I won't give away the whole end, but I mean, pretty much the resolution happens and then the song comes on. It's like, that's what it's supposed to feel like. And that's, I think that's why I thought it kind of worked for me.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't fit with the rest of the soundtrack.
Right.
But I think that's why I liked it, because it was like, okay, because the whole, I mean, as crazy as this one night is, that's really all it is. It's like, get home safely together. And that's the only thing that mattered. And so when they finally did and, you know, resolve the conflict and the miscommunication and all that, then they should feel the relief of, okay, we made it. You know, not all of us made it, but we did it. So yeah. I don't know. But yeah, you could have done that with a number of different songs or a different kind of whatever, you know, whatever, however you wanted to close with it. But I mean, they're all splashing in the waves kind of thing. Not splashing, but they're kind of walking, just kind of chilling out for a while. And they must be extremely tired, but anyway. Yeah, I guess we'll agree to disagree.
Extremely tired, definitely.
They should be, right?
Yeah.
This is an interesting movie because I wouldn't say it's a great movie, but it has like an 89% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's listed in a number of top 50 cult film lists.
Yeah.
You know, it's so as we go from movie to movie, it's to me, one of the things that's been fascinating is how time has been favorable or very unfavorable to some of the things we review.
Yeah.
And this is one where, you know, it was a success from the box office, but then here it is, you know, about almost, you know, 40 years later, and it has this, you know, people have a high opinion of it, even though a lot of the theme, the way it's done and all that doesn't live up to today's standards.
Which, yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
But maybe that just shows that the film really was a good idea, you know, that what it created, you know, still is of interest.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, well, should we quickly hit that? Does it resonate with a younger audience? And
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I would have a, I don't know. That's a tough one. I'd have a hard time imagining a young sort of early 20 something watching this and enjoying it.
But you were very young and
I was very young. Sure.
Maybe that's,
but
that's
you know, I mean, when we were little, you know, CGI wasn't really a thing. You know, certainly when this was made, it wasn't. I mean, Tron was really the first movie to use computer-generated graphics, and it'd be many years before it was done well. So you know, the effects, what little effects there are, you know, it's all in camera, of course, and it doesn't really need effects. But I feel like some, you know, a movie-going audience today is expects a certain standard, you know, a certain polish on a film. I don't know. I could be wrong.
But do you think, I mean, it's not that you don't think it's right for a certain age. It's just that they probably wouldn't get into it at all.
Yeah, I just don't think they'd get into it.
Yeah.
To sort of look past its flaws, you know, and sort of see what it has, you know, as its strengths more so.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the questions, you know, that we ask for the other movies, like, is it suitable for kids? I'd say no. Is it worth going back and watching? You know, if you're into films, yeah, you know.
But yeah, definitely.
You know, if you're in college and you're into movies and you've seen a lot of them and you want to know the history of movies or things like that, this totally is one of those things that should be on that list.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we definitely hit it out of the park, like that baseball game. This is our best review ever. Oh, sorry, that was cheesy.
I think that said, I think we beat this one to death.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, definitely our best review, though.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah.
What are we listening or what are we talking about next, Sean?
We are doing Let It Ride, back to our wheelhouse of late 80s, 1989.
Sweet.
Perfect. All right, look forward to it. So this has been 3 Men in a Movie. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you in the next episode.
Adios. It's the film with three brains.